The following is provided through the IAAIS Program Share Service.
Hello and welcome to this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman with the Virginia Voice. Our first article is from Booked, A Traveler's Guide to Literary Locations. A Street of Strivers in Port of Spain, The Novels of V.S. Naipaul, Port of Spain, Trinidad. V.S. Naipaul, winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Literature, was known for giving a lighthearted, even comedic treatment to his stories of poverty and despair in his hometown of Port of Spain, Trinidad. Despite being impoverished British subjects in the Caribbean during World War II, and members of the Indo-Trinidadian sub-minority to boot, his characters insist on seeking a sense of dignity beyond despair. In Miguel Street, his 1959 book of linked stories, Naipaul describes life on the street, where he spent time living with relatives while growing up. It's based on Louis Street in Woodbrook, a section of Port of Spain. The colorful characters in the book, objects of both ridicule and admiration, partake in shenanigans like running illegal brothels, gambling, starting up sham schools, and making signs promoting businesses, tailoring, and carpentry, even though they never do anything at all. Many of the characters on Miguel Street are resigned to the conclusion that things will never really get better for them and their neighbors. Thus, their constant drinking and violence, especially against women. Well, what you expect in a place like this, one character hat asks when another, Bigfoot, tries to make something of himself. Beneath the schemes, low expectations, and limited opportunities, however, is a desire to still find meaning and beauty in their beaten-down world. From an eccentric man on the street who calls himself B. Wordsworth for Black Wordsworth, the Nepal-like narrator learns what it means to be an artist and discovers that, unlike all the macho men on the block, when you're a poet, you can cry for everything. In Nepal's next novel, the more famous A House for Mr. Biswas, 1961, a man struggles all his life to transcend the unfortunate circumstances of his birth. Mahoon Biswas is born severely underweight and has six fingers on one hand, a sure sign of bad luck, according to his family. Later in life, Biswas is fired from his job as a journalist and has to move his family from one rented house to another. Despite all this, however, Biswas is committed to the pursuit of happiness. How terrible, he notes, to have lived without even attempting to lay claim to one's portion of the earth, to have lived and died as one had been born, unnecessary and unaccommodated. By the end of the story, which returns to the beginning, Biswas has finally achieved his dream of owning his own home. The house on Seacom Street is so impressive a structure, it could be seen from two or three streets away, and was known all over St. James, Nepal's stand-in for Port of Spain. It was like a huge and squat sentry box, tall, square, two-storied, with a pyramidal roof of corrugated iron. Biswas has succeeded in laying claim to his portion of the earth. As the narrator of Miguel Street puts it, while many might look at the Trinidadian streets from the outside and say, slum, we who live there saw our street as a world. Mr. Biswas's house was based on the one at 26 Nepal Street in Port of Spain, René Paul lived with his parents before his move to Britain to study at Oxford. In 2013, the renovated structure opened to the public as the Nepal House and Literary Museum. The bottom floor looks as it did in Nepal's childhood. The Friends of Mr. Biswas, a nonprofit that owns the property, is collecting Nepal-related memorabilia and restoring the outdoor gardens. Two apartments in the house are available for rent to scholars of Trinidadian culture. That was A Street of Strivers in Port of Spain, the novels of V.S. Nepal. Our next article is from NationalGeographic.com. Hear the song of Trinidad, drumming and dancing, singing birds and sound waves. This Caribbean island marches to the beat of its own steel pan. By Eric Felton, August 25th, 2016. Thundering, clangoring, the air around me throbs and shatters with the sound of steel pans. I'm in Queens Park Savannah, a big patch of green in the heart of Port of Spain, capital of the island nation of Trinidad and Tobago, and I can barely move. To my right, more than 100 musicians hunch over their pans, their hands moving in a choreographed flurry as they strike at their steel drums. To my left, 129 more play just as furiously. In front of me, yet another steel pan orchestra makes its own riot of sound as it competes with its rivals. We all are backstage at the finals of Trinidad's top steel band competition, Panorama, held the Saturday night before Carnival. 10 large bands have lined up along the paved track that leads to the grandstand stage. Each is jamming in a final rehearsal before the contest begins, hurtling through its competition piece. My ears try to absorb the astonishing clash of grooves and melodies. Astonishing in part because the sound is ear-splittingly loud without electronic amplification. It's as if the modernist Charles Ives had composed in the Caribbean. Many of us think of steel drums as the default sound of the Caribbean islands, a sort of oral equivalent of an umbrella drink. But this percussive instrument belongs to Trinidad. The improbable feat of turning discarded oil drums into sweetly melodic instruments was conceived in the rougher and rowdier neighborhoods of Port of Spain. Called pan locally, the steel drum is a deceptively difficult instrument to master. Unlike the piano, or my instrument, the trombone, where notes are arranged in a line, on a pan a C isn't next to a C sharp. It's on the opposite side of the bowl. This both flummoxes and captivates the jazz trombonist in me. Always on the hunt for new sounds and musical ideas for my own jazz orchestra, I couldn't wait to get to this, the world's most intense and joyful showcase of pan playing. I'm in the middle of a crush of fans who've come to help their favorite bands by pushing pan. Sets of steel drums sit on wheeled racks. Fans and panists together roll each band's drum battery along the pavement and eventually up the ramp to the stage. I wedge my way through the crowd looking for bands familiar to me. I spot Phase 2 Pan Groove, one of the top large steel bands in recent years, headed by Mozart of the Pan, Len Boogsy Sharp. The players, in exuberant red, yellow, and green vests and caps, show the easy confidence of frontrunners. Nearby, I find the Supernovas, a young band fresh from the northern hill town of Surrey. Until last year, the Supernovas had competed only in small band competitions. Now they've bulked the band up to 120 players, and in their first go at the Panorama semifinals, almost bested Phase 2. It doesn't hurt that they're led by Henri Samaru, son of one of the great original Pan men. I grab a Trini brewed Carib beer from one of the stalls that line the track and press through the fans until I can no longer move. Above, a banner proclaims Desperados. The fans right here aren't just more plentiful, they're more intense. As is the music. Somehow, in the tightly packed quarters, people are dancing to the fierce rhythms of the Desperados Steel Orchestra. This band, affectionately known as Despers, connects right back to Pan's Mean Street origins in the years around World War II, when no respectable Trinidadian parents allowed their kids to have anything to do with the instrument. As one early Pan innovator, Carlton Ziggily Constantine, said of the bands in the 1940s and 50s, "You must have a little villain in you to be a Pan man." Bands would fight, sometimes violently, over girls, turf, songs. Typical was this 1950 headline in the Trinidad Guardian newspaper: "Steel bands clash, corrosive fluid, cutlasses used." The Desperados formed in Laventille, a gritty neighborhood in the hardscrabble hills that overlook Port of Spain. A lingering Bad John reputation remains a measure of the group's authenticity, which clearly is valued by the loyal following I see here on the track. Some say that street brawling gave rise to the Panorama competition, devised to channel any hooliganism into something more productive. Around the time Trinidad and Tobago achieved independence from Britain in 1962. Not that anyone in Trinidad needs a reason to start a competition. Trinidadians will turn almost anything into a contest. Among the dozens that lead up to Carnival will be one for Calypso King, Best Calypso Singer, and for Soca King, Best Singer of the Island's Modern Calypso-Derived Pop. Trinnies, as Trinidadians call themselves, even consider the singing of birds a sport. Not surprising on an island that counts more than 450 bird species and honors an 8-time Calypso King named Mighty Sparrow. In a park one afternoon, I spot men lahooking bird cages to stands. The bullfinches inside begin tweeting and whistling and what are known as bullin' sessions, which can last the day and include no small amount of betting on which birds will sing the most. Bird song is both lure and reward at the 270-acre Acerite Nature Center, a top Caribbean birding spot that sits high in the crease of a mountain east of Port of Spain. I barely have my bag out of the car trunk when I'm startled by some unseen fowl's hoarse call, followed by what sounds like the klaxon honk of an old Parisian taxi. Crickets, frogs, and breeze-blown trees provide a background hum. Perched on the hillside before me is an elegant dowager of a plantation house, white with narrow green shutters. Bird watchers armed with binoculars and telescopic lenses flock to the veranda, which overlooks a valley lush with ferns and palms and flowering vines. A disproportionate number of the birders seem to be retired computer science professors, but I also chat with the leader of a Canadian Bee Gees tribute band. Guides on the veranda and along the forest trails help with bird spotting, pointing out everything from green-winged parrots difficult to see in the foliage to deftly darting hummingbirds. Many birds initially are identified by their song, which rallies the musician in me. I pick out the modest little whooping of the green-winged motmot. It seems embarrassed to be making any sound at all, and the squeaky chittering of thrushes. The bearded bellbird, bearded thanks to its throat wattles, makes a noise like a race starter's buzzer, followed by what sounds like the banging of a lead pipe on an old brake drum. That buzzer sound is a warning to other male bellbirds or intruders to back off, says guide Caleb Walker, while the clanking is a come-hither call. The green-backed trogon alternates a mewling whistle with the toot-tooting of a third grader taking up the recorder. But to my ears, the best of all will be the extravagant call of the yellow-tailed crested orapendola, a song that starts with the roll of a toy snare drum and surges into a comical calliope arpeggio. Midway into this new game of mine, I discover birds I'd much rather see than hear. Topping the list is the scarlet ibis, Trinidad's national bird, which visits Asa Wright but congregates in the Caroni Swamp, an estuarine reserve south of Port of Spain. That will be my next stop. First impressions underwhelm. Hard by a highway exit, I find a dirt parking lot and a small dock where a jumble of boats with bench seats moor in a canal. One boat is inviting passengers, so I board and we head out. Within minutes, the canal gives way to mangrove cloistered estuaries that open onto a string of serene tidal lakes. As the late afternoon sky eases from blue to dusky mauve, clusters of scarlet ibises, more like electric crimson ibises, so intense is their red-pink hue, swoop in low and fast over the water, and in a flurry of flapping, pull up to roost in the mangroves. There are so many of them, thousands, that their red feathers against the green foliage make the trees look like giant pyracantha bushes. For a place only 8 miles from the capital, Caroni Swamp feels improbably remote. The same could be said about Trinidad. Whether by choice or an admirable indifference to touristy imperatives, Trinis have not gone out of their way to make their natural attractions easy to get to. I'm eager to visit Pariah Bay, a secluded cove known for a natural stone arch. I could reach it by driving the winding roads into the hilly northern range, to road's end at the village of Brazo Seco, then embark on an hours-long hike. Or I could hire, as I now do, a fishing boat at the coastal village of Las Cuevas, an hour's drive northeast of Port of Spain. I find a sharp-nosed skiff skippered by Barry. On board is a fisherman named Neil. The sky is cloudy as the boat slaps across rough waters. Neil stands at the prow, scanning for rocks and reefs, as we wend our way around jutting caves topped by lonely trees. Tarps strung just behind Pariah Beach flag where a handful of families live. Otherwise, the cove feels deserted. At the far end of the sand, I make out a high stone arch buffeted by waves. It's such a striking spot that just about any country eager for tourist dollars would have paved a road to the water's edge. But Trinidad has built its economy around its primary resources, oil and gas, not tourism. As one Trinidadian expat I know said, drawing herself up with pride, we're a nation, not a tourist destination. Which may be why I now have a remarkable place like Pariah to myself. I stroll the sand to the arch, known as Cathedral Rock, which I now see frames a rock pillar that looks like a pulpit. On the way, I keep an eye on the water for leatherback turtles, 10,000 of which cross the Atlantic Ocean every year or two to nest along Trinidad's beaches and one of the world's largest leatherback gatherings. They usually begin arriving in March, however, and it's only February. None cruise by. Trinidad culture is built around habits of sociability, especially lining, a term Trinidadians invented for hanging out. One can make a line anywhere, at a bar, at a park, by the side of the road, anytime. But the essential line is the weekend river line. On a Sunday afternoon, I head with guide Gerald Nicholas into the Northern Range, the chain of low mountains that rears up east of the capital. Opting for a guide is a good idea for first-time visitors to Trinidad. Many smaller routes aren't marked. Soon we're on a road following a stream. Through trees, I see families and friends picnicking riverside. Nicholas hollers to a clutch of men in swim trunks, cooking over campfires on a sandbar. They wave us down. Bindra Singh and his friends greet us with beers icy from the cooler. We shoot the breeze over a boombox blaring Chutney Soka, the Trini music that mixes pop with Indian rhythms and Hindi lyrics. Thousands of Indians came to Trinidad as indentured laborers in the 1900s. "A line is all about friends and food," says Singh. "They feed their fires driftwood and bits of broken bamboo to heat pots arranged on three river rocks. I ask, what's cooking?" "Curry duck and provision soup. The latter, a mix of bananas, peas, peppers, carrots, taro, dumplings, and whatever else might be on hand. I get a first bite of the duck, which comes out of the pot as sizzling hot as it is spicy." A gaggle of kids splash around downriver as parents lounge along the banks. Other limers plop foldable tables right in the stream for one cool picnic. A young man wades past with a homemade spear gun, a hand-carved gun stock rigged with rubber bands to catapult a sharpened shank of heavy wire. He's hunting fish for a lime of his own. Another popular lime is hanging out at a pan yard. A few nights before the panorama finals are to take place, I'm in the pan yard, essentially a paved lot, where the Supernova Steel Orchestra rehearses in its hometown of Surrey. It's past 9 p.m., and Supernova musicians are still arriving, many straight from their jobs more than an hour away in Port of Spain. As the players set up, the various sections begin working on their parts. In front sit the high-pitched tenor pans that usually carry the melody, and the double tenors that harmonize with them. To the left are the guitars, cellos, and larger mid-range pans that strum chords under the tenors. On the right sit the oil drums, as many as a dozen per player, that bang out the bass notes like industrial timpani. On a platform in the back is the engine room, with a drum kit, congas, bongos, and other rhythm instruments. All are playing their own trickiest bits over and over, a discordant jumble of sound that builds and builds as more players arrive and join in. That is, until three sharp bangs from a cowboy bring instant silence. It's drill master Sonala Killer Samaru, who, after a pause, wraps out a rhythm that starts the song. What happens next astounds me. I've heard plenty of steel pan, but always by small groups. A couple of panists at a party, a pan soloist, and a jazz band. But I've never heard a full steel orchestra perform live. So I am utterly unprepared for the onslaught of sound when more than 100 panists strike and sing. And the Supernovas are very much in sync. Tightly drilled, eager, attentive, they stop and work the hardest sections over and over. The cowbell kicks them off fast. Then they do the part again, this time at a snail's pace, then once more at just the right tempo. They're playing a 7-minute arrangement by Amrit Samaru, whose father and Sonalal's brother Jeet started a little family steel band as a school kid in the countryside and became one of the great pan pioneers. "Everything I learned was from him," Amrit says. Plenty of panists read music fluently. But the tradition remains to learn every note directly from the pan of the arranger. Even now, just days before Panorama, Emery goes from section to section, tweaking the arrangement and showing players new variations. Little surprises for the judges come the finals. This all is wonderfully new to me, but old hat to the residents of Surrey. Instead of complaining about the racket, which, after all, has been going on for some 2 months now, every night until 2 or 3 in the morning, the neighbors are out on their porches liming. The Pan Yard, where Phase 2 Pan Groove practices in an upscale part of Port of Spain, is another experience altogether. Brightly lit and billboarded with ads for Yellowtail Chardonnay. Bleachers teem with the band's many fans. The players are rehearsing Mad Music, a dance tune with a singable melody bouncing over repeating riffs. It's a happy, easygoing vibe. Where the Supernovas were taught with youthful ambition, Phase 2 grooves with the relaxed ease one expects of winners. Relaxed would not be the word to describe the Desperados, as I watched them rehearse the following night in a borrowed, dimly lit Pan Yard in a scruffier part of Port of Spain. When their cowboy counts off, it's an entirely different sound, heavier, darker, that I hear. Despers play Pan with a wide-shouldered, muscular swagger, and if the musicians aren't exactly scowling, I don't see many gratuitous smiles either. This is a serious orchestra rehearsal. Desperados will be the penultimate band to perform at Panorama, so it's nearly 2 a.m. when they finally take the stage. The grandstand crowd hasn't waned a bit. As the players position their many steel pans, commentators doing a national TV broadcast note how long it has been, a 16-year drought, since Desperados came out on top. Finally, a drummer raps out a rhythm and they're off, with all the ferocity I'd heard in the Pan Yard a few nights before, performing a piece titled Different Me. By 3 a.m., the last band has played and the announcer calls out the score. Third place is a tie, 283 points each for the Renegades, and disappointing their fans, Phase 2 Pan Groove. Second place, with 284 points, goes to the Young Hopefuls from Surrey. The Despers fans begin to roar. Desperados have finished first by 1 point. The band finally is beaming. In an age of world music, where producers scour distant places to capture every sort of indigenous song, there still is music that remains elusive. Elusive because recording it can't come close to reproducing the actual experience of its sounds. This may be nowhere more true than at the Panorama Finals. What I now know, you can't grasp steel pan music until you've heard a large pan orchestra play live in a pan yard, and you can't know Trinidad without doing the same. That was Hear the Song of Trinidad, August 25th, 2016. That's all for this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman for the Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.